Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Food is essential to life, but cooking food well is not a skill any of us are born with. Not all of us have the time, money, or inclination to take cooking classes either, or had parents who taught us to cook when we were growing up. So enter cookbooks. Many of us have a copy of The Joy of Cooking or another all-purpose cookbook in our kitchens. And many more of us have specialized cookbooks as well that focus on a cuisine or a cooking technique. Cookbook sales are outpacing many other kinds of books, but how many of us actually use those cookbooks to actually make a dish or a meal? Kyle Cherik has done some research. He's a culinary historian and essayist and also a Lake Effect contributor, and he joins me in the studio now. Kyle Cherik, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Bonnie. How are you?
I'm doing really well, and we're going to be talking about one of my favorite things, which is cookbooks.
Which is a great thing to do in the early 2020 years as people make resolutions to do things, and many of them are to cook more, whether that happens or not, but it's a dignified and it's a good resolution.
One of the things I love about cookbooks, though, is when you look at them, particularly the historical ones, it kind of gives you an insight into the culture that was happening there. We might think we know where that dish came from, or we might think we know what it meant, but it might often not mean what we think.
Exactly right.
And I love digging back into the old ones. My mother collected old American cookbooks.
Right.
And so there were always, and she would use them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it was mostly to have them there as just like, isn't this interesting? They made this in New Hampshire in, 1706.
Right. Right. Well, yeah, they're probably, just because I know my history too well, they probably weren't doing cookbooks quite then, because our first American cookbook is 1796, but with Amelia Simmons. And we'll get there, but it's so true that these are cultural markers of the time. And in the case of Amelia Simmons, it tells us so much about what Americans, at least on the East Coast, right? That sort of bubble.
The colonies.
But that's where most of America was. And she was working as, she was an orphan, and she was working as a domestic, and she was working as a cook and things like that. And in those days, to be self-published was not a dint on your shoulder. Many people were, heck, Walt Whitman published himself because, he was a printer. So self-published wasn't a big deal. The really interesting thing with her American Cookery cookbook was that the person that edited it, we don't know who edited it because she gave it off to a printer and said, this is my cookbook. And it sold very well. And out of it, we've got a lot of codified recipes that now we just take for granted.
Like what?
Well, the American drop cookie, I mean, basically the chocolate chip cookie, comes out of that. And if you talk about, does America have a pastry tradition or a baking tradition? You know, all of that came from Europe. But the drop cookie is an American invention, and she codifies it for us in that book. What's really interesting, though, is that the person that she didn't know was editing it essentially changed some of her dispositions. She had some very, very, very strong feelings about meat. She had some very strong feelings about eating in the season or when to eat these things and so forth. And they just said, nope, that's not what I agree with. I'm gonna rework it. I'm going to put these things into different chapters and so forth. And now we look at it and say, wow, this is a really amazing, thoughtful work. The truth is, it is, but it's the work of two people, Amelia Simmons, and then
this unknown person.
This ghostwriter.
Yeah.
Yeah. That just grabbed the reins and said, this is what it's going to turn out to be.
So she was actually a proponent of eating within the seasons?
Oh, well, everybody was because,
well,
they had to. But the emphasis on it was very strong within that. And she was a proponent of sort of sorting through the seasons by way of the things that you could put up. So the things that they could be preserved. And it seems just common day to us now with the farm-to-table movement and so forth, which really started in the 70s. But, you know, to basically have that laid out that here, if you don't know these things, if you didn't automatically learn them from grandma, grandpa, aunt, uncle, what have you, here's the guide to when these things are best fresh. Here's when they should be pickled or preserved. And here's how you can use them, more importantly, later in dishes for deliciousness.
Because if you're going to pickle it and then not eat it,
what's
the sense?
Well, if you're going to eat it, but you're going to eat it because it's just the calories that you have at the time, here's how you can use it by way of deliciousness. And it was this great practical guide to just, this is how we eat in America. And American food is very funny because if we think about what American food is, if you stop somebody in the street, they would probably say pizza, hamburgers, hot dogs, those are all things that we eat when we go out. I don't know the last person, aside from maybe the 4th of July, that actually made a hot dog at home.
Or made a pizza, not a frozen one.
Not a frozen one, yeah. And some people have pizza stone, but it's really, it's kind of a special thing, and it's fun to do, and, you know, whatever. Friends come over, and you drink wine, and you make pizzas. It's not like this is Wednesday night, and we need to put dinner together. So American cuisine, or things out of cookbooks, is really an interesting anomaly. And we've had this robust dining scene for a long, long, long time. But when a Russian count toured America in the early 1800s, he said point blank, you don't have a cuisine, because everywhere he'd eaten, it was French. And that's where we've been living with cookbooks, this French hegemony, basically, until the 1980s. And we'll talk a little bit later about Lydia Bastianich, who you interviewed and then I interviewed in front of a live audience. You know, she was part of that Leonard Cohen, the crack, so the light gets in, you know, of Italian cooking that broke that French hegemony that had come basically from the 1930s and the World's Fair. So the way that French food became what it did here in America was during the World's Fair in Queens, over came Soleil and Farnay. And Farnay was just a low kitchen boy, but he worked his way up to head chef. And they ended up, Farnay in particular, ended up being best friends with Craig Claiborne, who was the incredibly influential, the nation's first restaurant critic. And if you look at the list of the best cookbooks in America, 100 most important, the New York Times cookbook, that one that he published in the 60s and then every year on forward through the 70s, they were all Farnay's recipes. They'd go out to Claiborne's place in the Hamptons. Farnay would cook, and Claiborne would type. And that's, you know, and then Julia before that, and that sort of thing. But French food was what we were cooking out of cookbooks now. And we've really moved on since then.
Well, what about cookbooks like Fanny Farmer's?
Sure.
And all of those earlier ones that kind of were passed down, you know, housewife to housewife kind of thing, mother to daughter.
Yeah.
Where it was the basic, I'm putting air quotes around, the basic American how to roast something, how to bake bread, how to just cook everyday basic things.
Yeah.
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 So where did those start happening?
Well, so Fanny Farmer is mid-19th century, and it's really a teaching school that she has in Boston. And that's where that cookbook comes from, making a huge story very small. But she was teaching women these incredible skills.
Home ec, essentially.
Yeah. Before we had, just as we get physical education from the Turners and that tradition, we got home ec out of Fanny Farmer. And it was really the demand and the interest to create that cookbook. And there's always been two levels of cookbooks going on in America. There was the Amelia Simmons American Cookery and Fanny Farmer and The Joy of Cooking and those sorts of things.
I have my dog-eared copy of that.
Yeah. And I would include The Immigrant Cookbook, which came out of Milwaukee, Lizzie Kander Black, incredibly influential. But that was this very straightforward, pragmatic, this is how you cook. Definitely it's delicious. Here's how you use the things. Here's how you can stretch them into other recipes. And then there was the fancy pants cookbooks.
The aspirational cookbooks.
Yes. Yeah. And we're still living in that age. And it's interesting, like the two women we'll talk about, Samin Nosrat, who I interviewed around the same time that I interviewed.
And she is salt.
Salt, fat, acid, heat. Yeah. Wild, wild cookbook success. I mean, she is in line with what Julia Child did for sales with Mastering the Art of French Cooking. She's on that. We sort of, you know, Julia Child and then the Silver Palette cookbook and then I don't even know what would be in between as far as success. And then you've got Samin's Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat. And at the same time, she got this incredible Netflix special that followed up. And, you know, her series was literally helping add subscriptions to Netflix. I mean, she went from writing for the Berkeley newspaper and helping Michael Pollan learn about food as he wrote his book to being an international star. In the food world, there are people in all of the celebrities in cooking that I've met in the past decade plus of going to the James Beard Awards or Kohler Food and Wine or various things like that, or the chefs that have come through. So Thomas Keller all the way through. So I mean, there are people that are exactly as you want them to be and how they are when they write or when they're on camera. And Lydia Bastianich was the same way. And then there are those that, and I'm not judging, but have a bifurcation of personality. Samin is exactly what you get when you meet her, which was incredibly delightful. And her book, to me, is interesting because it's a crossroads where it's aspirational cooking, but it's actually very basic reteaching of techniques. So it sort of sits in both camps. you know, we're living right now in the era of Yoram Adelenge, right? So there's this trend towards like Mediterranean, North African sort of Spanishy, Basque-y, Greek-y,
those flavors and those textures.
Yeah, and Adelenge's first book is, you know, Plenty, to me, is like Salman Rushdie's Satanic Verses, where everybody bought it, you know, is on the New York Times bestseller list forever, but no one read it.
And nobody's ever cooked anything from it.
Nobody's ever cooked it. But if you go to people's kitchens, you're like, oh, there's another copy of Plenty, but when did you make that eggplant that's on the cover? Never.
Okay, so that leads me to a question. I was like, what is driving this aspirational need?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, for people to have these cookbooks to say, oh, you know, that just looks so great and everything, but then actually never go into the kitchen and try making whatever it is that drew them to the cookbook in the first place.
I think it's a touch point towards the food, and I think that our social media and culture influences this. So since 2015, the two graph lines as far as grocery sales, which is up in the billions every year, and then restaurant sales, usually it was grocery was higher and then restaurant was, you know, flatlining or moving up, but grocery always beat out. They've, like in Ghostbusters, those of you from the 80s that remember that, those streams have crossed. So grocery sales have dipped down and restaurant sales have dipped up. And I'm talking by a billions of dollar spread. So people are not cooking. You can't cook without groceries unless everyone's suddenly farming in their backyard. But, you know, I don't think it's that big.
That would be interesting.
Yeah, right. Totally different discussion of ours.
Yeah.
So people aren't cooking at home as often, and they're definitely eating out. And eating out has become the national recreation. Buying these cookbooks, there's a couple of things happening. One, it's the touch point to the food that looks delicious, but in many cases people won't make it home, but it connects you to the chef. So in a way, eating out, right? And it's also the grand baseball card in the case of celebrity chefs like Yoram Adelenge or Samin Nosrat. You watch her on Netflix and then you want the cookbook so you can flip through it, but you don't actually cook out of it in many cases. So it's that Instagram you can hold in your hand that is this through point. Because cookbook sales since 2015 have been gaining momentum to the point of 20% increases or more. 2018 was 21%. The year before that was a little more than. But each year. So whereas publishing is supposedly dead in this digital era. And oddly enough, I can get pretty much any recipe that I want on my phone in my kitchen when we do cook, or some verisimilitude of it. If it isn't Yoram's, I can get a version of that, right? To go off of that theme. Yet cookbook sales are going
through the roof,
whereas publishing is sort of struggling and, you know, only the Don DeLillos of the world are making money.
So when you talk to all of the chefs that you talk to, mm-hmm. and most of them have cookbooks,
yep.
are they disappointed that people aren't actually cooking their food?
Every chef always wants people to cook their food. It's the strangest existential crisis I've ever encountered, and I keep waiting.
I'm buying the books, but I'm not going
to
cook.
Yeah, well, I keep waiting to find, you know, that the person that just takes a stand on one side or the other. But every chef, in the case of Samin, she doesn't have restaurants to support, so she wants people to cook at home. But in the case of Lydia, she has many, many a restaurant empire and Italy to support, so she wants people, one, buying groceries to cook and then going into her restaurant, right? Every chef I've ever met says, oh, no, cooking at home is the most important thing you can do. You should cook. You should share with your friends, your family. It creates traditions. They'll go on, you know, till my ears bleed about how good that is. And then they're like, but come to my restaurant.
Come but to when my you don't yeah. want to cook.
let me cook for you.
Yeah. Yes.
And Daniel Ballou, we had this conversation where he gave me the book. He was here a number of years ago at the Grain Exchange, lovely Bartolotta event, gave me the book, his card, his cell phone number, come to New York, we'll cook for you. I don't know if you'll use any of these recipes because it takes, you know, that sort of thing. But do you cook at home? I said, well, yes, of course, chef. Yes, I do. But it was like, but still, come to the restaurant. Come to the restaurant. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like they've had to split their, mm-hmm. you know, their desires in a way. It's
yeah.
like I'm cooking for you, but I also want you to try the things that I've
right.
created in this book.
Well, their restaurant yeah. is definitely their wife, but, you know, cook at home is their mistress. Otherwise, it just doesn't work with cookbooks.
Don't bring the cookbook to the restaurant.
Yeah.
Because that could be really ugly.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, but, and there are people that eat out every night. And I think that would just get tiresome. I mean, I know those times in my life when traveling and so forth. And, by the seventh, eighth night, you're just looking at another menu.
Right.
It really gets to be exhausting.
Yeah, there is something about a home-cooked meal, mm-hmm. As simple can be,
yeah.
that sometimes is exactly what you need. And if only because you don't have to be on while you eat it.
Yeah.
Like in a restaurant, you're still around other people. There's a certain kind of, you want to be polite to the wait staff. You want to, be polite to your companions, whatever it happens to be. But you can just sort of relax
at home. Something else is interesting has happened in that. So if you go out, when we go out dining, one of the things that really troubles me but I can't do anything about is the F and the P. So it's the food and the phone. And I see people not conversing. If they're sitting alone, they're basically looking at a little 3 or 4 inch glowing thing in front of them, and they're missing the magic of the food. And I'm talking even if you're at a Big Bowl or something.
I was going to say your local fish fry.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah. I mean, there's still there was human intention and thoughtfulness, varying levels, but still, you can't. It's not Star Trek. You can't just create this, hit a button, and boom. There's fewer and fewer things where actually human energy. And as you go up the scale, artistry comes into play. And
that directly.
Correct.
It's like where you're the recipient. It's literally a one-on-one exchange.
Yeah. And there's nothing more intimate than food. You put it in your body. What else do we put in our body? We put air, we put water, and we put healing medicines. I mean, when you really break it down, and food is a form of medicine, of course, but... I mean, it's so intimate, and we miss that when we move into this other space through our phones. The other interesting thing that's happening in our culture, a lot of the consulting that I'm doing right now is in the urban food space within how folks are developing Milwaukee, Madison, other cities, that sort of thing, and placing the right chefs with the right projects. And I was sitting in a meeting, and the president of one of the biggest developers here in the city said, one of the things that we're challenged with right now is our mail and package spaces, not because of Amazon, but because of the overwhelmingness of Blue Apron, et cetera, that is filling up these spaces. So there are folks that are living in these gorgeous, by my standards, lovely apartments or condos in a full urban experience where there are restaurants that they can, in many cases, walk to. And they want to cook at home, but they don't know how to, or they're too busy, or whatever their reasons are. So they get this, the cilantro is already chopped, the box that comes, and you're really just combining. Julia Child is rolling over her. She's probably swearing, in fact. She's probably. Yeah.
In French.
Slamming the wine glass down and swearing. And if this is an access to people eating a little bit more inventively and nutritiously, I guess that's good. It's a really, really interesting time in American culture because we have cookbook sales up. We have, in our city alone, we have 50 or 60 restaurants opening every year. And then we have food being delivered that's basically all but prepared, nearly instant, filling in people's, mailboxes.
Well, and the other thing I've noticed is that the Food Channel, you can now subscribe and get quote-unquote live cooking classes with people like Bobby Flay or whoever happens to be on the roster of Cooking Channel, you know. And so it's like the Peloton of cooking.
Right.
It's like, and I'm thinking, nobody I know is cooking.
Yeah.
And again, that's like aspirational, something.
Well, and are people watching it because of the entertainment value of Bobby Flay, who's a fantastic entertainer?
Right.
Or are they actually cooking along with him? When Julia did it in the 60s, people were cooking along with her. When President Eisenhower's another national address, basically preempted her show, WGBH, got thousands of phone calls, and then in the ensuing week, another thousands of letters, angry, saying, "What are you doing?" That's when we learn how to make, that's our Julia. Well, the president had something to say. Whatever. We get the paper at 5 o'clock. It'll keep. I'm learning how to make Bouillabaisse.
I was going to say, I'm deboning a chicken.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
And I don't think we, I know we don't have that connection. And the Food Network is also, that's them sort of scraping, saying, how do we win at this streaming game and this direct contact where it's the McDonald's, where really the Burger King ethos, where you can have it your way in whatever media you're consuming, whenever and wherever. I mean, everything short of from your Apple Watch to your massive movie screen television, your
Well, I have to say, there is something I still love about picking up a cookbook. I still have a number of my mother's old ones. Mm-hmm. You know, the covers are kind of coming off, and I haven't made anything out of them in years, but I still want them.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a connection not only to her, but to that earlier time and who we were then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No question.
Yeah.
No question. And they really are time capsules of what's important to the culture at the time. I mean, the growth of vegan and vegetarian cookbooks that are coming out in 2020, or that won James Beard's in the last couple of years as best cookbook, or that they even have that category, best vegetable-centric cookbook, tells you something about the culture. Mm-hmm. Where 6-8 years earlier, meat was everything, right? And people were in love with bacon, and now we're swinging in a different direction. As a food historian and a culinarian, this is just fascinating to keep an eye on.
You are going to have lots to do.
Lots to
do. You're never going to run out of things to talk about.
No, good to go. Yeah.
Well, Kyle Cherek, it has been such a pleasure.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Talking about this. And now I have to go look at my cookbooks.
Yeah. Exactly.
Maybe I will actually make something.
Well, and in a little bit of prep for our discussion, I may have put about 45 cookbooks in my cart on Amazon. I'm just saying.
Yeah. You might want to take a few out.
No, they're all just reference points. I'm probably not going to get them all, but someday.
Someday. Kyle Cherek, thanks.
Thanks, Bonnie.
Lake Effect contributor Kyle Cherek is a culinary historian and essayist. You can find more of our conversations about food history at wuwm.com.